very cool. Fortunately, you have to do it as root. You can actually mount fuse file systems as not root, but because we are going to loopback mount it afterwards, we have to do root. So what this is doing is, have a look at the command line. It's launching this fuse loopback subsystem program, which is in Python. And then it's telling it to mount it on the /temp/mount, which is a temporary mount point, giving it all the RAID parameters, the ones that we came up with before, using the guesser, and then, you know, giving it the offset, etc., and all these file names for it. And so it actually is going to go off, and now it's installed and it's mounted. So actually, you know, we can even do like a mount, and, you know, we can see it there, you know, it's mounted on the on temp mount. So what we can actually do now is we can use the loopback. This is the standard garden variety loopback kernel module. There's nothing exciting about it. To just mount this. Now inside, I'll just show you that before we start. Inside that virtual file system that we created, there is actually a file called mount.me, right? Which actually is supposed to represent, you know, that people should mount it. So that's just an example of, the file doesn't really exist. It's a virtual file. It's not really there. But it's just a way for our program to indicate that this is really the DD image. Now, because due to size issue, our program doesn't necessarily need to know how big the reassembled thing is. So we just say it's 10 terabytes. Yep. So I've got a 10 terabyte file on my laptop here. And I'm just going to loopback mount it, right? Mount the mount.me on some mount point somewhere. And then I can just, you know, do an LS of that. And that's the contents of the file system, right? So we can do an LS of it. And so we can just use it normally, right? The file system itself is all written in Python. And then so what happens is each time we're trying to access the mounted file system through the loopback, it goes back to the fuse module, and then it goes off to Python. Python reassembles the RAID partition and then, you know, and sorts it all out. So anyway, after all this, we actually are able to mount our image. And it's quite cool because we can actually mount anything that's supported by PipeLag's subsystems that way. You know, we can actually mount the like an NCASE file, for example, or a compressed file or whatever. So that's actually quite a useful tool. So in summary, I mean, in the past, really, RAID acquisition used to be really difficult. Like if you went to a job doing a forensic job, and they said, okay, you know, we suspect there's someone hacked our server. You know, this is our server, and he's got the RAID. Used to go, oh my God, you know, I don't really want to do this. And I used to find an excuse to say why it wouldn't work. So it was actually quite difficult to do. Mostly because it really took a long time. You know, I mean, if you're looking at a 3 terabyte server, you know, it could take you days and days to actually copy that. And then how are you going to actually manage this sort of size? But now it's really cool because we're able to acquire them in parallel. So, for example, if you have a 3 terabyte server with 14 disks, you can potentially actually copy 14 disks at once. And so you can actually increase your imaging capacity, you know, by 14 times, effectively. So, you know, this is just a bit of a calculation, sort of back of the envelope type calculations. You know, it will take you 36 hours to acquire something like that if you were to use, say, an optics boot disk or something. But if you did it in parallel, it would just take you, you know, a few hours, 4 hours or something. So, and, you know, if you don't have... you know, traditionally you also had to use Ethernet and USB stuff, and that was hard. So in conclusion, you know, acquiring large RAID arrays is pretty practical and possible. You know, it's quite useful. You don't really have to do it all manually. As the libraries of different controllers increases in that script, the guesser script, then, you know, we can guess faster and faster, and so we can actually probably support most controllers eventually. At the moment, we support a great deal of them, but I don't know, I wouldn't say most. So, and then data recovery of RAID arrays is possible. We had this one case where there was a spike, a voltage spike, and half of the array died because of that. There was a 6-disk array, 3 disks died. So because the arrays are usually bought at the same time, all of the disks are actually exactly the same. They're bought at the same time, the same place, etc. So what we're able to do is you're able to get the boards, the control boards, off the ones that died and put them on the ones that off the ones that didn't die, put them on the ones that died, and actually we were able to read the data off all of the disks that way by you know, moving control boards around, and and then we were able to reassemble it offline. So we were able to actually get data off a RAID array which, you know, lost half of its disks, which, you know, we wouldn't be able to normally. So it's quite useful. If there's any questions, questions? Cool. Oh yeah, sorry, one question. Not during the normal hooking, but we can run, there's a program that checks the parity. When you actually check the parity, all you do is you check the parity for the whole disk. You really have no, you don't really care about the structure of it because the parity will be the same. Like if you just take one disk and XOR it with the next disk and XOR it with the next disk, you'll get zero for the whole disk regardless of blocks or anything. So you can just do, there's another program that just verifies it. But if the parity is wrong, then it's hard to know which one actually is not right, which disk is not right. So you can actually remove one of the disks and say not to use that one, and it will actually rebuild the data from the other disks. You know, but no questions? Cool, fine. Yes. How does it? Would it stand up in court? That's a good question. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell, really, because you know, it's really up to the court to decide what's, you know, what would stand up in court. So I can't tell you that. But I guess it's impossible to really do it any other way. I mean, the image is already scattered across a RAID partition. So without knowing, you know, what the image. You know, if you were to get those parameters wrong, the chances of it actually making sense are fairly small, I would say. Right. Yes. I mean, that's still not going to be changed because as you're taking each image of each disk, you still hash each disk, right? So you can say that the individual components haven't been tampered with. So then when you put it together, then the argument is whether the process of putting them together has tampered the logical image at all or not. Yeah. Okay, no more questions? Okay, we are actually running a little bit late. I think that we were going to go till 1, so we are running a little bit late. But if Craig, can I introduce Craig, please? And there you go. In his talk of computer forensics. Thank you.
Okay, I'll try and make this fairly brief so that we can go and have a bite to eat. But I'm Craig Pearce from RMIT University, and I'll be discussing how to perform a live analysis of a crime scene and maintain integrity while doing that and using open source tools in that live analysis. So I'll cover some of the basics of computing forensics. I'll keep that fairly brief. Then I'll go into detail on how a live analysis can be performed while maintaining integrity. And if the results of that show some interesting things, then I can show some briefings that could be done to do a further analysis, which would be known as a dead analysis, or some people might know that as a post-mortem analysis. So some of the basics of digital forensics is, I guess the main point is acquiring evidence in a non-questionable way, and that evidence could come from many sources of hardware and also software. I won't touch up on the software mechanisms because most of those are done in the post-mortem analysis stage. But I guess the main point in doing this is any tools that you use should not touch the underlying hard disk because if it does, then integrity could be compromised and in a court of law it would not hold. I guess the defendant's lawyer would try and make a motion to suppress the evidence, and generally with these sorts of things the case lies on the forensic evidence at hand. Chain of command is important as well when dealing with such investigations, even if it's just a simple little investigation being asked to do in the office. I mean, if depending on the results you find, it could end up going to a prosecution. So if you don't go and document with your paper-based documentation, then obviously integrity and authentication is going to be questioned. So it's important to do the right steps, even if you think it is quite trivial. So some of the things that can get in the way with an investigation, generally these are from a technically savvy attacker. Encryption, such as disk encryption. Linux has got EncryptFS, which is getting easier and easier to set up. Windows has got the encrypted file system. So basically, if the attacker has an encrypted file system mounted and you wanted to investigate the computer, generally what happens is you reboot the computer and make a bit for bit disk DD copy of the hard drive. But if the image is encrypted, you may not have access to the key, and unless you can subpoena the key from the attacker, you will not be able to access encrypted content, and that's where some of your vital information may be stored. So that's one issue. And also, network communication can be encrypted. Anonymity, the attacker might choose to try and hide their identity. Second generation onion routing, mixed nets, crowds, there's many ways to try and give yourself sender or source anonymity. And more what we're tackling here in this presentation is volatility. A lot of information for an attack will remain in memory and in maybe temporary files on the hard disk, open files and network sockets. There's lots of sort of temporary information which will be lost upon reboot, which could be important for an investigation. And I guess finally, one other issue could be some of the forensic tools might not support all file systems. RISER-FS seems to be a common file system not supported by several forensic tools. Okay, so we've got a bit of a contrived or artificial scenario up here where you've got an attacker who's, I guess, done something naughty. It could be in the workplace. And the manager might have said, hang on, what's going on here? Can you check it out, see what's going on? So the attacker might be using disk encryption, but more importantly, we want to get as much information as possible about the scene, because maybe security's just taken him off the computer he was using, and there could be some processes running open files and things to give some clues as to what was happening. But the most important thing here is any tools that you use can change the underlying hard disk, and that will change its integrity. It might change your modification, access and creation times of files, and it could change checksums if some of those tools accidentally write to the disk. So it's important to make sure that the tools you use do not in any way write to the hard drive. Some of the reasons why you might perform a live analysis instead of rebooting the machine and doing a dead analysis include, I guess, getting that volatile information out of memory. Your employer might decide, we don't want to prosecute you, but we want to, I guess, learn from the attack so that it doesn't happen in the future. And it might be on a critical server that cannot be afforded to be rebooted. So the first step would be to secure the scene. I guess then make a recording of what was running on the computer. So a good way to do that is take a photograph of the computer screen before you start touching it. Digital cameras are very common now, so that's easy enough to do. Also record the system time of the computer. Not every computer uses a trusted time clock with NTP or something. Clock skew happens. Often computer clocks aren't configured properly in the first place, so it's important to get the current system time and check that against what you perceive the real time to be, and record that offset. And that'll help in later dates when you're analysing log files and things like that, so that you can put it into perspective of where the attacks took place. So once those basics have been done, then the data can be acquired off the system in a live analysis form, and it's most important to do that in the order of volatility. So you get the most temporary and most risky information first, stuff that could easily be lost, and then work your way down to the more non-volatile information. Once you've finished the live analysis task, it's important to record the current system time again, and I'll try and make this interactive, but why should we record the current system time again? Any guesses? Clock skew? Yep, and also to record the session when you were actually involved and running commands. So if anything fishy comes up in log files and you were actually running the system at that time, it's important to flag that. Also, message digests should be taken, and they help with integrity and authentication of the information. I'm sure most of you know, but Mason2, I just generally work on a variable length input which hashes to a fixed length output, and that's a secure hash function. The basic principles there are not two input messages shouldn't hash to the same output message, and if they do, that's known as a collision. And also, it should be computationally feasible to have a hash output and try to derive its hash input. Okay, so the open source toolkit that I'm using in this scenario is Helix, and that's written by a company called Events. And Helix is a NOPFIX-based distribution. It's bootable, and you don't have to boot from it. You can actually just mount it in a CD-ROM, either on Windows or Linux, and run it online. So it's very flexible in that regard. It's also got many server and client tools, so you can run NX off it, which is like an optimized X11 session management tool, which is probably a lot quicker than VNC. If you wanted, you could run an NFS server and all those sorts of things, but most of the servers aren't useful for a forensics operation, but they're there for other operations, such as if you wanted to image a lab or rescue a computer or something. It's got UnionFS if you wanted to temporarily write to a CD or customize it for a specific investigation. And it's also got many tools that can be used for post-mortem analysis or dead analysis, which I won't be covering in this talk. So back to the contrived example, if you were investigating a scene where an employee's done something and your employer wants some results of what happened, you might be using a laptop, for example. You could boot that laptop using Helix. I've just got a copy here. The ISO is available on the web. It's GPL'd. And so you could boot up your laptop using Helix, and that will give you a X11-based session where you can run whatever tools you desire. And on the suspect host, where the alleged attacker has been taken away from, you could then put in another Helix CD into that and mount that. And then the trick is, how do you get the information from that suspect host so that you can analyse it? You can't store it on the suspect host, even as a temporary file, because that'll modify the underlying disk contents, and then integrity has been compromised. You can either, use a USB key. I've just got one here on report at the moment. So you could plug this one into the computer and save all the files to it. But of course, USB may not be set up on the host correctly. More popular at the moment method is to use a client-server approach with, say, Netcat or something, so that the output from your live analysis can be streamed over the network transparently to a Netcat server running on the investigator's Helix workstation. Also, there's a few notes on the suspect host. All the commands that we run, we should be using IP addresses and not host names. Can anyone suggest why we shouldn't be using host names? There's a couple of reasons. Can't trust the host. Yep, can't trust etc. hosts, or and if it doesn't have an etc. host, you might need a DNS server, and that's another issue. You might not be able to trust a DNS server. DNS lookups are slow as well. And if you gather everything just based on IP addresses, you can do your DNS lookups offline at a later date anyway. So it's more efficient and more secure by just getting your... Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so it'd consult the etc. host file and change the access time on that file. So, yeah, that's a good point. So just get host names where possible. When you're running the commands on the untrusted host, on the suspect host, you shouldn't be running any commands from its file space. Again, it would change access times, and those binaries could be Trojan. So it's important to run... copies of trusted binaries that are on the CD-ROM. Also, it's good to, obviously, documentation is very important, both paper-based and electronic. If you don't do that, then authenticity will be questioned at a later date. You've got to remember, it might seem like a trivial investigation, but depending on the results, the employer might decide to prosecute, and if you haven't followed these steps, then this will probably not go to court as evidence anyway. Now, Unix has got the script command, which is good. It records all the commands that you run and the output from those commands to a text file. And then you can type exit and it'll exit the script and save a script. I think it's typed script by default. But would you run that on the suspect host the investigator's machine or both. What would you guys think? Yeah, exactly. So you couldn't run on the suspect host, unless there was a way of somehow saving it to physical memory only and not the hard drive. But definitely a good idea to run script on the investigator's machine so that you can at least show half of what was happening, one side of what was happening. Okay, so here's a few commands that I've nutted out from a few resources and tried, and this is like a quick and dirty way of doing a live analysis without changing the underlying disk content. You generally wouldn't do environment variables like I'm doing here. I'm sort of doing that to, I guess, save space on the slides because some of these commands like go a bit too wide. But firstly, I would mount the CD-ROM. I would export a environment variable to say where the CD-ROM mount point is, so that then I could run all my trusted binaries from that mount point. Using Netcat for communications, we've got a Netcat client running on the suspect host and a Netcat server on the forensics workstation. The option Z, minus W, that says wait for I think 3 seconds while trying to send some information across the network. We specify the forensic workstation's IP address and a port number, and similarly the server will start a socket on that port and listen for connections. And you see with the server, appending any output it grabs from the Netcat client to a file on its own hard drive. Also with the client, it probably should change its path environment variable so that just by accident if the investigator types something without specifying mount CD-ROM, they don't want to run a binary on the hard drive of the suspect host. Again, that's because we don't want to change MAC times and we might not be able to trust it because it could be Trojans anyway. So firstly with the, remembering we're using the order of volatility, getting the most temporary information first, the most transient and changing information, that's probably a file and network connections. So the first command is lsof, that lists all open files and network connections on the suspect host. We've provided a few flags there. The minus N is to just give numeric IP addresses only. That's to do with the network sockets part of LSOF. And then we run netstat to get a list of... Netstat gives similar results to LSOF, but it's different in its own right. I mean, netstat will show what programs are bound to what ports that are open and things, so we may as well run that as well. The options for netstat, NAP, N's for numeric IP addresses only, A is for all connections that are running on the system, and P shows you what process was the one that initiated that network socket that was opened. And thirdly, we will have a look at the routes, the routing table of the client, and communicate that information across the network to the Netcat server running on the forensics workstation. And finally, for the networking component, we'll see if any programs have been executed that then delete the files that it executed from. Basically, what I'm trying to say there is sometimes you might have a binary which you run, and that's now in memory, and part of that program will be deleting its original binary or any temporary files it used. Rootkits generally use that approach, so we can find out if any processes are doing that. Is there any questions so far? Feel free to interrupt at any point. Yep. If my say stuff. Oh, right, okay. Yeah. If there's a rootkit running on the system, like a Linux kernel module or something running on the untrusted host, it is quite hard to detect that because I might be using my binaries from the mount CD-ROM, but it might have something lower level hooking that. Some people say, well, it is a hard problem. You can sometimes see if there is a rootkit running by trying to install a rootkit of your own. And if you try and install your own rootkit, it will have problems because there's another rootkit running. So that could be one way to detect that. Yeah, that's true, but we're trying to do analysis online where a system's been used by an attacker and they've got complete control over that system, and we're trying to get any information from that system before we reboot it and put it into a trusted environment. So we're trying to get we're trying to get authenticated information from an untrusted environment. So it is a hard task, but we can get that to some degree. Yeah. Into a dead analysis, yeah, that's possible too, but the trouble with that is if the attacker is skilled and they're using encrypted file systems, then you've lost a large resource of information already, so it's good to at least try and extract some information safely before doing a dead analysis. But I guess that's another thing, if there is a rootkit running and you haven't detected that, it might be smart enough to start deleting information when it detects that you're trying to gather information from the system. So, first of all, it would be good to establish whether rootkit is running on the system or not, and if it's not, then it would be safe to proceed. Okay, so once you get some file and network information from the live system, the next part would be gathering process activity. The PS command, depending on whether you're running Solaris or BSD or Linux, it's got different flags, but basically, let's look at number two because we're at a Linux conference. So we're looking at all processes from all users on the system and any sub-processes, and the minus L flag also specifies the parent process ID, so that allows you to, I guess, construct a hierarchy of processes of how they're executed and who executed them on the system. And if in the process list you find something that's a bit suspect, you might want to investigate that further. So you can use pcat, and pcat generally, what pcat does is copies the memory space of a process. And that's handy, so if you've found a process which is dodgy and you might want to investigate at a later time, you might be able to find the binary or the source code for that and learn how it works. If you don't have the source code, you'd have a binary which you might have to reverse engineer. But that only gives you the code part of the program, it doesn't give you the data. So using pcat, you can actually get the dynamic information that that process was using, so it's important to get that in a live analysis because that won't be available to you in a dead analysis. And you can get user information. If it's a multi-user system, then you might have some privacy issues, which I'll discuss a bit later on, but Google will show you all the current users on the system, when they logged in, what terminal they were logged into, the last command they ran, how long that last command had been running for. There's lots of information there. And if you've got the time and space, it's handy to get system information from Prof, so you can maybe tile that up and send that across the network as well, possibly. Prof also includes your PROC K core file, which is your physical memory. So it's useful to get physical memory, but just keep in mind, the trouble with physical memory is it's non-contiguous. It's very hard to actually get information from there. The best thing you can do with physical memory is probably run strings across it or something to get some text strings. It's really hard to analyze physical memory. Swap space. Sorry, my voice is getting a bit croaky, a bit tired. But swap space is probably useful to get as well because it won't be available after a reboot. So you would have to find where the swap device is, and if it's not too large and you've got the time, then maybe communicate that across, along with any encrypted volumes, which if you can't subpoena a key from the alleged attacker, then this might be the only time when you can get the encrypted volumes. Because we'd be assuming here that the user might have an encrypted volume. When they log into the computer, they type in a password, and that then mounts the encrypted volume in a plain view format. And also a temporary partition, because some distributions are set up to clear the temp partition when booting up, so temporary files might not then be available after shutting the machine down. And also file access times, so your modification, creation and access times are available too. Notice that the ls command there doesn't actually change access times. Things that change access times are things that will read a file, write to a file or change a file in place, but ls doesn't actually read the file, it just looks at the contents of it. Sorry, yeah. It will change, ls could change access times to the directories, that's right, so that is a risk. That's something that you may or may not do depending on, I guess if, depending how things are looking at this point, if further investigation is required, then you may not run ls because it will change the integrity of the disk, or the directories, yes. Sorry, just over here, yeah. Okay, that's assumes that you've got a root console, though. You may not, the attacker might not have left you with a root console. Is there a question over here? Yeah? Yeah, that's probably true. Turn the machine off, then do a bit-for-bit copy of the disk, and that way you don't lose a temp. Yeah, that's right. But also, I guess we're dealing with, remember there's running processes on the system, so one of those running processes might also delete a file from temp, so you might have a chance to catch it now when in 15 seconds later it might disappear, possibly. But that's why I guess I put temp towards the bottom of the list of order volatility, because it's more permanent than some of the other information. No other questions on this slide? Okay, so I've said why not message digest checksums. Any guesses why we don't grab checksums of the file system at the moment? Yeah, exactly, they read the file, so access times get changed. But we should be taking message digest checksums of the information we've gathered from the system, and that will prove that, say if I'm handling some evidence from one point, then pass it on to somebody else, that will prove that one of us hasn't tampered with the evidence. Okay, so there's a lot of scripting there and a lot of possibility of typos which could result in integrity and authenticity being compromised. So Helix provides an incident response script to automate such tasks. This script isn't the same as what I've come up with, but it could be modified to suit. And it can be modified to suit the type of investigation being or the environment that needs to be investigated. So it's pretty easy to use. Say if this was the suspect host, you could just put the CD-ROM in, mount the CD-ROM, and run the incident response script from one of the trusted binaries, and that script runs only trusted binaries from the CD-ROM. But at the moment, some of the trusted binaries aren't actually running, they're seg holding, so that could be a platform issue. But the thing about static binaries, they've got to be compiled for a specific platform and specific GCC version numbers. I did have a bit of a demo using, I don't know if anyone has used XvidCat before to capture running screenshots and things like that, but I had a demo, but I decided not to go with it because of the seg file. But some improvements can be made to Helix and the general approach. One of those is actually renaming the trusted binary so that you can't accidentally run a binary which will run the suspect host's binary instead of the trusted binary. And also using encryption. So instead of just communicating that information across the wire using Netcat, you can use some encryption just before communicating and decryption after the forensics workstation has captured it. I just threw in the data encryption standard here because it's quick and dirty and fast, but it's as we all know, it's not very secure. It's only a 56-bit block cipher. But if the information only has to be secure across the network for half an hour or something, then DS might suffice. Yes? You could use SSH, but it's probably you'd then have to have SSH set up on the client and on the server to do. Helix probably does have, it does have an SSH client, but it's more work, I guess. You could easily use also you've got the public key encryption overhead as well, so using just a symmetric key encryption would be a lot quicker. If you wanted a stronger cipher, you could and Helix does have GPG, which is a GPL version and patent-free version of PGP. GPG could be used with, it's got many lock and string ciphers, it's got Blowfish, Advanced Encryption Standard and other ciphers available which you could use instead of DES. But you see on the server's changed a little bit, so the server's listening for a Netcat connection from the client, it receives that, it would then have to pipe that data to a to be decrypted. And once it's been decrypted, that would have to be written to file. So we can use DD to write that to file. Okay, there's some other issues too. We're assuming that the suspect host has a working network card. If that's not the case, then and they do have a working USB, you could use a USB mass storage device. And if there's no way to get the data off, then forget about a live analysis altogether and just turn the machine off and do a dead analysis. Because you don't want to... Otherwise, if there's... no reason at all to do any further investigation. You might as well just do a live analysis and not worry about the integrity of the underlying disk, but that would only be done if there was no possibility of a future investigation. Second point is removed from the automated process, but just from my notes, I was just running Netcat for the client to serve each time, but using the automated incident response script on Helix, that removes that issue. Copying, you know, the POP file system, temporary file systems, and swap space and stuff does take a lot of time, so time is an issue, and the longer a live analysis runs, the more chance that it will, by accident, it will change the underlying disk. So it's probably worth your while thinking, do I need all this information or not? So I guess categorising what's most important, what's not. And privacy is a bit of an issue too, so depending on the expectation of privacy for the network and policies that have been signed by users, you might have to not run some commands if they give too much information away or change the parameters. Some of them are easy to change, such as the who command accepts a user ID. So if it's a multi-user system, you can just specify the ID of the suspected attacker, and same with PS, but other commands work on the entire system and not just on a subset of user IDs. So once a live analysis has been performed, we're going back to the whole paper-based stuff of you know, writing down your documentation, who the evidence was given to, signing it off, dates and times and things like that. I said before that you could photograph a computer screen before you touch it. You could even make a use a digicam and record all the steps you did from start to finish for authenticity as well. And once live analysis has been performed, you would shut the computer down. If you've got a root console and it's running EXC2, it's probably worth trying to sync your memory buffers to disk and then shutting it down properly, as opposed to just pulling the power plug, because EXC2 can have corrupted file systems if you just pull the power plug, and corrupted file system will mean data loss, and some of that data loss could be information that could have been critical to the investigation. But if you're using a journaling file system, you could probably just pull the power plug and be done with it. And once that's done, you could then start a dead analysis. Here's just a simple chain of custody form. So these things are available on the net too, and they should be filled out even if it's a trivial investigation, just in case it ends up being the employer wanting a prosecution. Dead analysis, again, you can use Helix. You could do a quick and dirty dead analysis by having a forensic server and booting Helix up onto that, or installing Helix with a hard disk, and set up the NX server so that clients could then log into the NX server. So we've got a bit of a scenario here. Obviously, we won't be performing analysis on the original hard disk. We do a bit-for-bit copy first and put that in secure storage. So you can see the investigators using NX clients, they could run their preferred operating system, whether it be Windows, Mac or Unix, run NX client from there, and that'll establish a X11 based session on the NX server. So it's not like remote desktop management. It gives you a full-on, your own personal X11 session, so that each investigator could then perhaps, like, they could work in pairs and do the same thing and see if they get the same results, or they could work on a different part of the investigation all in parallel, all using the same forensic server. I think we've done this to death. There's probably no point talking about this, but hard image is great for a lab where you want to image the, when you want to dump an image of one machine across an entire network of identical hardware, but you wouldn't use that in a forensics environment, obviously, because hard image doesn't do a bit-for-bit copy, and bit-for-bit copy is what we need for a dead analysis. Hard image makes some optimizations. You can see Z1, it does first-level GZIP compression, splits volumes over 700 meg images, if you like, but more importantly, it ignores unallocated space, and there can be potentially information there to analyse in unallocated space. I won't cover dead analysis because it's been covered by both Dave and Michael. But autopsy, sleuthkit, PyFlake, all these sorts of tools are available on Helix, all on the one CD-ROM distribution, which is, as I said, is bootable. It can be mounted online from Windows or Unix. And from there you can do your dead analysis, and such approaches have been discussed in earlier presentations. So I guess just to sum up, the key point with live analysis is it gets information that is very volatile, stuff that will be lost upon reboot, things like open files and network connections, possibly encrypted volumes and other temporary information. But in getting that information, you there's any possibility of a future conviction, if you want to take this further, then make sure that any tools you use do not in any way modify the underlying hard drive. Okay, is there any questions? Yeah. You wouldn't want to do any host lookups on the suspect host. You could do them on a trusted machine elsewhere. That's fair enough. But if you do it on the trusted host, it will change the underlying disk, like the etc. host file, for example, and take longer. But if you've got the resources, then you could have somebody else doing the host name lookups on another machine separate from there. Good point, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely, that's right. There's no absolute sort of method in this case. There's always going to be some level of doubt as to how much the hacker knows, yeah. Okay, thank you.
It's not a requirement to have a PhD, obviously.
Yeah.
We don't discriminate against people with a PhD.
Oh, cool. That's the thing I was wondering about. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it won't hurt in any way by having a PhD.
No, no, no. I've got a PhD too, but it wasn't a requirement.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, cool.
I can find out and send you an email and then but it depends what you want, because there's a lot of different areas that do different things.
Yeah, I like the hands-on stuff. So.
Yeah, we have a graduate recruitment drive, which is like every year we have an intake of some new graduates.
Yeah,
and but that's not really specific. So you sort of go around